And what I want to avoid is any controversy. We had controversy in last month's talk, so I want to avoid any possibility of any controversy, so I thought tonight I'd talk about other realms of existence. So if you are allied, deeply allied to Western enlightenment and reason, hard luck. Right, where to begin? Oh, that's the point, isn't there? There is no beginning. There is no first beginning. The Buddhist teaching does talk about there being many realms of existence, many dimensions to existence, that it isn't just the human realm. And it's like a cosmic game of snakes and ladders. And you can go up ladders, and you can go down the snakes. And it's all dependent upon how you behave, your actions. And we all know that our actions have results. So everything we can talk about in terms of other realms, we can see corollaries in our own human existence. So for instance, there are many levels of existence, from the deepest, darkest, most terrible realms that you really don't want to visit. If you can at all manage to avoid them, that's a good thing. And I can certainly tell you the sort of actions that would guarantee that you end up in those realms. I think we would call them hell realms. Then there's the animal realm, which we are familiar with, because the animal realm intersects with the human realm. So we are actually aware that there are other realms. Point that out. Animals, different realm of existence than ours. Okay, then you have hungry ghosts, and we have hungry ghosts in our human realm. Addiction, for instance, is a... they're like hungry ghosts, people who have addictions. Then we have what are called the Azura demons. They're a nasty bunch, so they're like politicians. They're very envious and hell-bent on power, that sort of thing. And then next up in the order of this game of things comes the human realm, us. And we're special in that all the other realms, there are quite a few reasons why the human realm stands out. But whereas all the levels below the human realm are more painful than pleasant, and the further you go down, the more painful they become, human realm is fairly equal distribution of pleasure and pain, as we know. Another couple of things that make the human realm stand out is that it's the realm where spiritual transformation is possible. The other realms are more resultant-based. They're where you go because of the actions that you performed in the human realm. So it's the human realm where our actions really count most. Whereas in the other realms, it's more just about experiencing. In that way, the human realm stands out. And then above the human realm, you start to go into what we call sense-sphere heaven realms. So they're becoming increasingly pleasant as you go up. So all those combined are what we call karmaloka in the Pali. So that means the sphere of sense desire. So all those realms from the hell realm up until the highest sensual heaven are all regarded as karmaloka. And then you have realms beyond that, which are called rupaloka and arupaloka. Rupaloka means attenuated matter, so it's not as heavy and dense in terms of physical matter, it's a lot lighter. So in the same way that our dreams, it's not an exact corollary, but just as our dreams, there is shape and colour in dreams, isn't there? There is sounds, there is stuff going on, but it's not the heavy, dense matter that we experience in this sensuous realm. And then above rupaloka, you have arupaloka, which is the world of pure mind. So there's no matter, per se, in all of that. And these existences outside the human realm can be extraordinarily lengthy, and you go there based on primarily on the actions that you perform in the human realm. Just to reassure you, it's very, very difficult to go straight to hell from the human realm. You have to have done something really very, very naughty. I think naughty is putting it mildly. Wounding an historical Buddha, killing an arahant, so that's somebody who's enlightened but not an historical Buddha, killing your mother or your father, and creating a schism in the monastic order, the Sangha, are all deemed actions with fixed results. So there's nothing that you can do. That means that you have to, unfortunately, visit the lowest realms of existence based on performing those kinds of actions. There are actions with fixed results which produce extraordinarily beneficial positive rebirths, and they are getting into any of the jhanas, the fixed meditations. That is an action with a fixed result. And this is obviously pertinent to the Buddha's teaching, because the Buddha's teaching is firstly establishing that life is a lot more than this one lifetime. There's stuff that's gone on before, there's stuff that come later, and there is this continuous flow of consciousness. It's never the same moment of consciousness. Consciousness is not eternal. Consciousness is arising and passing away, but there is this unbreakable flow. And if you understand this, then you can learn to direct that flow towards experiences of greater peace, happiness, benevolence, comfort. Things like keeping precepts, selfless service, practicing loving kindness, all help to ensure that you get a positive rebirth, that you go up a ladder rather than down the snake. I don't know why I'm laughing. Going down a snake is not funny. However, it is still samsara, so no matter how wonderful the rebirth, and no matter how long aeonic that rebirth in these extraordinary realms persists, there comes a point when the karma that produced that result reaches its end, and you have to leave that realm. And that, my friends, is dukkha. That is suffering. To have spent an aeonic period of time in utter bliss, and then to have to leave that realm and then not know where you're going to go next, is not cool. So there is this terrible problem that there is no true lasting peace in any of it. You cannot find that true lasting happiness even in the most blissful states. The most blissful states come to an end because everything is transient. So the Buddha's teaching is, first of all, telling us how to get the most from samsara, how to live out the most comfortable, most pleasant existences, yes, of course, but he's also pointing out in his higher teaching that there is no end to that process. It is an endless game of snakes and ladders. You can't just like end the game, you know, it's just you get to that far corner at the top and you think, ah, I've won. You just endlessly go round. And you don't want to fall below the human realm. So the Buddha's highest teaching is about how to transcend the whole wheel of rebirth. Great, so there you go. So that was good. That was probably one of my shortest ever talks. I'm glad about that. Any questions? So Paul, this is really the elephant in the whole discussion, isn't it? The elephant in the room is, how do you prove it? What kind of evidence is there for it? We are deeply mired, that's not quite the right word. We are deeply established in the culture of the Western Enlightenment. We need objective proofs for these things. Well, look, in one sense, none of us has very long to wait in the grand scheme of things. So just stay mindful. I definitely shouldn't be laughing about death, but I don't think it's that big a deal, really. Consider. I mean, firstly, this isn't proof, but consider. It's like, we basically have three main options when it comes to what happens at death and after death. One is that we're annihilated. One is that we experience some kind of eternal heaven or eternal hell or eternal purgatory. No, purgatory is not eternal, is it? But some kind of eternal heaven or some kind of eternal hell. Or there is just a never-ending succession of rebirths. Okay. So if it is that there is a self and it's annihilated at death, well, if it is truly that there is nothing, in the most absolute sense of the term, that there truly is nothing, then that's fine, isn't it? Because there won't be any pain. There won't be any pleasure, there won't be the loss of pleasure. It would be fantastic. except nobody feels like that, because everyone feels like it's actually an annihilation of me, which doesn't sound like a good thing at all. At which point I tend to say things like I say, I did want to keep this up and happy, but I would say things like, well, can you have nothing without something? How is nothing to be known? If nothing is known, then there has to be the knowing of the nothing, which implies consciousness. If there's consciousness, there has to be some kind of support for that consciousness in some kind of environment that supports the support for consciousness, in which case you have life. So for there to be nothing, there always has to be something. I'm glad we got that sorted out. Always like to get past that one. Now, when it comes to eternal anything, would you really want eternal life? That means something which does not change. Think of the most fantastic sort of heavenly existence you can think of, and then think about being stuck with that for eternity. And then you start to find it difficult to see a difference between an eternal heaven and an eternal hell. They seem to be the same thing. The Buddha's teaching, the Buddha pointed out that there is no self to be annihilated in the ultimate sense, and that also there is no possibility of any kind of eternal existence. And he talks about there being a middle way, which is coming to see that there is this flow of consciousness which takes many different forms. It's never the same for two moments, and it goes from existence to existence to existence, fueled by this desire for experience, fueled by this never-ending process of trying to find truly lasting peace, happiness, and well-being. And so the analogy I like to use is that of, you have a light bulb, you have the filament of the light bulb, you have electricity passing through the light bulb that heats up the filament and you get light. Every now and again, the filament breaks, you have to take out the bulb, put in a new bulb, and you get light. Is it the same light, or is it different light? It's a different light bulb. Is it the same electricity, or is it different electricity? Well, it's a continuous flow of electricity. It's a continuous flow of light. It's not a static, unchanging thing by any means. And so you get this, start to get this idea that there is this movement, this constant change that's going on, and every now and again we just have to change the light bulb. You have to have an environment to exist in. There has to be the sense bases, the medium through which we continue to experience objects. So there has to be an environment in which that body can operate, in which case then mind can operate and consciousness can occur. So there has to be, consequent upon the breakup of this physical base, there has to be a new base in a new environment in order for that conscious flow to continue. So, brilliant, but that's not proof. Of course it isn't. I'm not sure how much proof I actually have for you. In the Pali Canon, you hear or you read so many stories about the Buddha and his monks leaving their bodies through the development of their concentration powers. It said that the Buddha was able to leave his body with the ease of a strong man just stretching out his arm. He could do it so easily. And he would go into other realms and teach other beings in other realms of existence. And again, our Western Enlightenment conditioning is going, oh, I'm not quite sure about this. So it's well established in the Buddhist teaching that there are many different realms of existence. Not only that, beings from other realms of existence would come to this human existence to go and listen to the Buddha discourses. And so you find many mentions of devas, beings from heavenly realms, coming down and listening to the Buddha's discourses. Some of the monks were able to see these devas and others were not, dependent on how well developed their mental powers were. And this all sounds really far-fetched until you realize, or you discover for your own experience, that it is entirely possible for you to leave your own body, your physical body. Has anyone here had an ubi? Out-of-body experience. They're not that difficult to do. Well, it depends. A meditator reports that. He was very interested to see whether he could make one of these out-of-body experiences occur. he had heard that it was possible in that place between wakefulness and proper sleep, when you go to bed at night, that there was this period where it was actually possible to engineer, intend a way out of the physical body. So, being an open-minded sort of chap, being a meditator, he thought, well, he'd give it a go. And he wasn't sure whether he'd heard it from somebody else or whether he'd just made it up, but he found a method. And the method was that he trained himself by walking downstairs. He would lie on his bed, he would get up out of his bed, he would walk round the bed to the door, he'd walk out of the door, down the stairs, counting all the stairs. He would walk out to the back door of his house, and then he'd stand in his garden. And he went and he practiced this many, many times. And he would observe everything that was around him. He would count the number of stairs, he would memorize the different pictures and photographs that were dotted around. Whatever he could see, he would memorize. Then when he went to bed, as he was falling asleep, or waiting to fall asleep, he would mentally rehearse that route, remembering everything that he could remember about that route. And so each night he would fall asleep. And then one night, as he was falling asleep, and he was a meditator, so he was developing his mindfulness and his concentration, he realized that his arm was poking through the mattress and was touching the floor underneath the bed. And this struck him as incongruous, not quite right. So he felt a little bit more, and he felt his arm actually go through down to the next floor, the room underneath. And he thought, this definitely isn't right. At which point he realized that he could roll out of bed. And so he rolled out of bed. But it wasn't his physical body. It was his mental body, for want of a better word. And he saw his body, the lump and form of his body, asleep in bed. And so obviously the first time it happens, it tends to go, and that's that. But he found that he could repeat it. Not every night, but if he kept up that process of developing that routine, he found that it would happen again. And so he started to walk out of the bedroom. He'd get to the door was closed, and he realized he could just pass through it. And he passed down the stairs, counting the stairs. He had the street light coming in the window, and he recognized that, and he walked down, and he walked down all the way down to the back door, and then through the back door, and I really do mean through the back door, and he'd be in his garden. And he discovered, directly for his own experience, that he was able to then go visit places. The first place he went was a church that was located in the town for some reason. Why he went there, I don't know. But it was dark, and there was a graveyard, and I think he got a bit scared of that. You do have to be quite brave to do this. So, essentially, what he was discovering, and he did go on a few trips, and funnily enough, this particular meditator, I don't understand this at all, sort of thought, well, I've seen that now, and kind of didn't develop any further. But he did get to visit a couple of different realms of existence, and met a few people and chatted, as you do. But yeah, he gave it up in the end. The point being that, therefore, you can discover these things for yourself. There is so much more to existence than we tend to allow ourselves to, I was going to say believe, but at least be open to. But people do have these experiences. You only have to go online and you'll discover there are an awful lot of people who do actually have these kinds of experiences. It is, in that sense, it is up to us. You can learn techniques. You can develop that if you wish. Like I say, none of us have, in the grand scheme of things, very long to find out for ourselves. But that's the whole emphasis of the Buddha's teaching, is that you can, through the development of your mindfulness, through the development of concentration, it is possible to discover the truth for yourself. It's not a matter of just blind adherence to a set of beliefs or values. You can find out directly for yourself. Even without specifically developing out-of-body experiences, obviously I shouldn't really talk about myself, but you know how as you get older, you tend to need to go to the loo in the middle of the night? It's one of the benefits of getting older, isn't it? They say there are benefits to getting older. And one of them is that you have to get out of bed when you're all nice and cozy and go down to the loo. There was one time, and even if you, you know, even if you stop drinking liquids at noon, you still got to do it. It's just what that's about at all. It's dukkha, suffering. Anyway, so there was one night, the bladder, the call of the bladder. So I got out of bed, and this was the uncanny thing, and this is what makes me appreciate how it can be that there is an intersection between realms. And it's all a matter of frequency, and it's possible to reach different frequencies, for want of a better word, and experience different things, because I was suddenly aware that in my field of vision, and I was wide awake, in my field of vision, there was an infinite display of geometric shapes, all occurring in perfect unison. There's so what we call nimitas, just bright lights in the mind, but then creating all these incredible geometric shapes and patterns, a result of practicing mindfulness and concentration, and just reaching that correct frequency range for that to actually occur. And it was a complete fluke. I mean, there's no skill in that at all. No, nothing happening. But it was just going off to infinity. No matter where I looked, it was happening absolutely everywhere I looked, but I knew it wasn't happening in the physical world. So if you came in and said, Paul, what are you doing? Well, my immediate response would be, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, what the hell are you doing in my house? But beyond that, I would then say, can you see these? And then you'd say, what are you talking about? So it was happening in my mental space, if you will. If your mental space was operating at the same frequency, for want of a better word, I don't know what the right word is, there's a possibility that you would experience that too. And then I could see how it is that actually, perhaps, people can see ghosts. Or it is possible that the Devas did come down to see the Buddha when he was giving a discourse, and some of the monks could see him and some couldn't. Just free your mind, guys. Obviously, I haven't been taking any weird substances. Just life, just high on life, you know. But these things are there to be discovered. Yeah, I think that's the point I wanted to make this evening. It's just a question of really what... Because I know that some people find this more difficult than others. But think about it. What would you like it to be? What would be the best... I know it's not proof of anything. Out of the three major things that could happen to you when you die, that's it. There's eternal unchangingness in some form or other. Or there's a whole cosmic playground, of which we are normally only aware of a little bit. But through development, you can come to explore. And it's full of change. It's full of new, it's always new, it's always surprising, it's always mysterious. The only problem is that we form attachments to it, and we cling to it, and that causes us to suffer. But it is possible to end that through developing the Buddha's higher teaching, and then you're left with this infinite playground. It has no outer boundary. It's just there to be enjoyed, and never having to come back to the human realm to learn more lessons, because you've learned all the lessons you had to learn in order to be free, and then you get to enjoy eternity, infinity, in any way you choose. That sounds good to me.